May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Gamaliel Negron. Based on nothing but a mere hunch that Negron might be urinating, the police unlawfully stopped and searched him and unreasonably claimed that his conduct amounted to disorderly conduct. In fact, there was no reasonable suspicion of any urination, and there certainly was no reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. And to the extent that there may have been a lawful detention, there was no reasonable suspicion that he was armed and dangerous, justifying search. What happened in this case was essentially the two officers were on patrol near the Clayton Court Apartments. For some reason, Officer Satterfield's attention was drawn to the apartment complex because there were people sitting out on the stoop. So they drove around the block, and by the time they got back around, there was no one there, but the officer decided to get out of his car, walk down the steps, and go into the courtyard. He did see one individual who was 20 yards away, and it turned out later to be Mr. Negron. He was standing with his back faced to the officer. He had a varsity jacket on, and he had pants on that were completely up. The officer, as he characterized it, saw Negron, quote, shake it off, end quote, and based on that, he made the assumption that he was urinating. Negron then turned around, and it appeared to the officer that he had zipped up his pants. The officer then said to him, you know public urination is a crime, to which Negron said, I know. He called Negron over, said, do you have identification, which he did not. He immediately cuffed Mr. Negron and searched him. At the suppression hearing, the officer offered two inconsistent reasons why he...
So when was he, from your perspective, taken into custody?
He was taken into custody the minute he called him over to him. The minute the officer called him over to him. He was stopped for Terry purposes. He was then, as soon as he did not have his identification, he was cuffed, which was unlawful at that point. The officer said that, first of all, my intention when I cuffed him and searched him was to charge him with disorderly conduct. He also said in the same hearing, the suppression hearing, that I cuffed him because I always cuff people when they don't have identification on them. So it was for officer safety. And instead of recognizing that contradiction, the trial court said, well, I believe that there's a lawful search because there was a lawful arrest for disorderly conduct, but it was also necessary for officer safety. There was no reasonable suspicion of urination in this case. Officer Satterfield will concede had a hunch that there was urination occurring. However, he did not follow up on an investigation, as unpleasant as it sounds, to determine whether there was reasonable suspicion of urination. Instead, he immediately...
Just to clarify your legal position,
yes.
Suppose this activity had taken place in a way that the officer could have seen that urination was taking place. Would that change your position?
No, there's alternative arguments here. First, there was no reasonable suspicion of any urination, and even if there was, that's not criminal activity, as it's not criminal under the statute that was in the affidavit of probable cause in the indictment, and it's not a crime under the statute that the state has brought up now on appeal as some basis for reasonable suspicion.
Should we interpret that as a no? It wouldn't change your position?
It would not change my position. I apologize. The reason there was no reasonable suspicion is that the officer had not gotten any complaints of any public urination. There was no one around. Mr. Negron's pants were fully up. The officer did not see any genitalia, any urine stream, or any signs that there had been urination. In fact, the affidavit of probable cause does state that he went over to the bushes after he arrested Negron and found no contraband. To base a stop on wholly innocent activities as a shake would be to allow the police to stop someone pretty much any time there's a movement that is innocent. And in State versus Fahey, the Minnesota Court of Appeals determined in a case similar to ours that a stance in that case was not reasonable suspicion of urination. So this is very similar to that case in that this is a shake. Public urination, though, is not a crime, even if he had been urinating. As interesting as that may be. But it certainly is not a crime under what the officer based his stop. The affidavit of probable cause makes it very clear.
Is it your position that under no circumstances can it be disorderly conduct?
That is correct. Because as the state has conceded, it's not speech under 13011B. And in its newly raised statute, 13011F, if creating a physically offensive condition, there's no indication that urine would do that. I mean, people take their dogs for walks all the time, and there's no physically offensive condition that's been created as a result of their dog doing his business. So it could not be criminal activity.
But New York, which has a similar statute, has held otherwise.
It did. And in other jurisdictions, they found, no, there's no, they're looking for situations that are like a stink bomb or something that would cause a distraction to people where, in one particular case, a gentleman was standing on the side of the road and they claimed, well, it was distracting traffic, so that was hazardous. So there are, it's split out there in the jurisdictions. Now, even if he's correct, that's completely irrelevant today. Ironically, the state spends a good portion of its brief talking about Negron trying to supplement the record, and then asks this court to look to factors that aren't in the record. In McDonald versus State, this court held that the affidavit of probable cause is the contemporaneous sign as to what was in the officer's mind. In this case, the officer clearly charged him in the affidavit of probable cause under 13011B. Further, he didn't testify to any objective factors that would demonstrate why he would have violated that. He testified to no objective factors to the statute that the state has belatedly raised to justify the stop in this case. And in fact, the state argued that there was reasonable suspicion under 13011B. So based on the record, what was in the record at the suppression hearing and in the affidavit of probable cause, the reasonable suspicion analysis must be based on 13011B, and no objective factors were set forth.
Let me understand your argument here. Let's assume that there is a direct statute making public urination unlawful.
Okay.
The officer doesn't know about that statute, assumes it's disorderly conduct, but all the things that he observes satisfies the other statute. Are you saying that because the officer is unaware that it violates a specific law, that there must be suppression, even though all the objective information would allow for a reasonable, articulable suspicion?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying, if in that case, if the affidavit of probable cause and the record before the court had objective factors cited by the officer that would justify reasonable suspicion of that public urination statute, then that would be a completely different situation where we're here today. It wasn't just an accident by the officer citing the wrong statute. Nothing in the record satisfies the fact that this is speech, which is the section he charged him under.
Well, let's follow up on that. Assume that all this activity took place in broad daylight in the middle of Rodney Square. Would that have created a reasonable suspicion? Would that be criminal under the disorderly conduct statute?
No.
Why not?
Because under 13011B, it has to be a display or a gesture, and the state has conceded that that addresses speech, and that's not what happened in this case. Now, actually...
Well, in other words, you're saying if this were done as a protest against some policy, then it might be disorderly
exactly.
conduct. If it's just a response to the call of nature, it wouldn't be.
That's correct. And then on this newly raised statute that the state brings to this court, the physically offensive condition, it hasn't been addressed in Delaware, but the position would be it would depend on the circumstances and how, you know, if it's right at the bus stop versus whether it creates a physically offensive condition. The objective factors that would address that, which are not in the record, would be asking him, going over and seeing if there was any urination that took place to satisfy his statute. there was nothing to indicate that it had happened and that a physically offensive condition had been created. And as mentioned, this court, McDonald versus State, held that the record is what the court must look to. And in State versus Redden, the Superior Court followed that that particular holding and said that the court cannot rely on a reason provided after the fact. The state adopted the officer's reasoning when it indicted Mr. Negron, continuing on the speech subsection. It argued reasonable suspicion based on that statute. It's only on appeal that the state has looked to this 1301-1B and 1F and decided, well, maybe there was reasonable suspicion of that. Now, assuming there was reasonable suspicion to stop him,
I'm confused about something. I thought the presence or absence of reasonable suspicion was based on facts.
That's correct.
And the facts that the officer puts in the affidavit, I can understand, would be the best evidence of the contemporaneous facts that the officer actually remembered. It may not be all the facts.
Right.
But what difference does it make whether he cites the correct or the incorrect statutory reference? Don't we have case law that says even if the arrest is made for the wrong reason, if it's otherwise a lawful arrest, no harm, no foul?
There's no dispute. I agree with that. What the difference is here there are no objective factors supporting in any way the other statute, assuming he's correct. And 1301 1F applies.
All right, well, now I have a better understanding of your argument.
I apologize. It wasn't clear. So even if it was a correct stop, then the frisk wasn't permissible because there was no reasonable basis that Negron was armed and dangerous.
Now, on that point, the issue is whether or not there was probable cause to arrest, not a stop. This wasn't a two-hour detention or a four-hour detention.
Well, I agree with that. However, the trial court made alternative decisions and actually said, well, it was incident to a lawful arrest, thus there must have been probable cause, which nobody has even argued that there was probable cause below. Then he said, well, in addition, it was for officer safety because every time he has somebody who doesn't have identification, he cuffs them. But he was not suspected of any criminal activity that is violent, like drug dealing. There were no threatening gestures. The officer testified to that. He was fully compliant. The officer testified to that. And contrary to what the trial court found and what the state asserts, Satterfield's partner was present at the time that the frisk was done. It's at A33 and A34. He arrived at that time. So there was no basis to do the frisk in this particular case, unless the court has any other questions.
Reserve your time?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. I find myself in the odd circumstance again. My last argument, I was before the court. I had to use language that I probably wouldn't normally use in court. And today I've got to talk about something that we probably don't talk about most often in polite conversation. But in order for the court to understand what it is that Officer Satterfield saw, and what it is that gave him probable cause to believe that Mr. Negron was in fact violating the law, the disorderly conduct statute, the court has to look to the record as to what he said. And what he said is that in a courtyard, and if I was in the center of the courtyard and that was DuPont Street, that would be the building, the front of the building, Mr. Negron placed himself in the bushes 5 feet away from the apartment door. And Officer Satterfield came that way from 6th Street through the courtyard and saw him to the side, first saw him about 20 yards away. And he explained it. He said, in layman's term, I watched, and the court can read it itself, but what a man does at the end of a urination process when he finishes and then zips up. What the defense wants to do is basically take us back in search and seizure law quite a ways. Certainly back past Illinois versus Gates and all the cases thereafter that this court has decided that says police officers can use their common sense. They are people. And when an adult male police officer sees an adult male finishing the urination process, he knows what that is. And it gave him probable cause to believe that's exactly what occurred.
Well, let's assume that you're right on that prong of the argument, that is, that the officer had reasonable, articulable suspicion, reason to suspect that this defendant was urinating. So let's eliminate the factual issue. The issue that troubles me is, so what? That is, it takes more than that to support a valid arrest.
But, Your Honor,
it has to be criminal activity, or that's either happening or is about to happen.
Or just happened. He actually sees the
end. Or it's just happened. What is your position as to that?
That this activity, Your Honor, does in fact violate Delaware law, that it is a violation of disorderly conduct. And the defense reads a little too much into the state's suggestion that 1301B may not be the best applicable section under this set of circumstances.
Well, you agree that the position that you're arguing before us is not the position, was not the basis for the indictment or the conviction. Is that correct?
I would.
That is, the conviction is predicated on B1, subsection B1?
The indictment did cite the language of B of 3201B. It did.
All right.
And, as did the affidavit of probable cause. And it could be.
Is that what was argued to the trier of fact, B1?
Actually, if the court were to look at the argument at the suppression hearing, there was very little discussion about what prong of disorderly conduct it actually would support. In fact, that's why the trial judge at the end said, I'm not sure you would get a conviction on this. At the very last page of the suppression hearing, I'm not sure you could get a conviction on this, because public urination can be a coarse display. For instance, Your Honor's situation in Rodney Square. That can be a display. It can be viewed as coarse. It can create the risk of annoyance or alarm of other people. And that's what this is about, creating the risk. They want to say it happened at night and he didn't actually see the urine or nobody complained or anything else. It's creating the risk of public inconvenience by certain acts. Did the police officer pick the wrong section in this particular circumstance? Maybe the trial judge is right. Maybe if this had gone before a jury, they would not view that activity as a display. And that may be reasonable. Reasonable minds certainly can differ. But the state suggests that he's in the right church, wrong pew, if anything. That in fact, what it is and what it falls under much more readily understood, both by the Model Penal Code and other states that have the same statute as ours, is 1301F.
Okay, so you're saying that it's fair to rely on the preamble to subsection 1. That is the preamble, which is the person intentionally causes public convenience, annoyance, or alarm, and so forth.
Well, that is one of the elements, that the person must intentionally cause public inconvenience, annoyance, alarm to any person, or creates a risk thereof.
Okay.
And the state suggests that he created a risk thereof, because if someone urinates.
All right. And before we get to that, is that also an argument that was fairly presented to the trial judge?
That it creates a risk thereof?
Yes.
Again, there was very little discussion, Your Honor, actually, of the elements.
Is that a yes or a no?
I would suggest no one specifically spoke of the elements, not the defense, not the prosecution, and nor did the court. No one said, these are the specific elements of disorderly conduct, and here's the evidence that plugs into it.
So the record doesn't really permit a clear answer to that question?
As to whether or not they focus on that specific element, no, it does not.
Okay. Next question. Since this activity took place at night, in front of a private residence, and nobody was near there, that is, was close by, at least as far as the record shows, other than the police officer, what is the risk of public annoyance other than one that's theoretical?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the police officer walked through that. It's a public courtyard. The apartments face out this way. It's an apartment building, not just a residence, but numerous people can come in and out of the front door, and he's 5 feet away from that door in a bush, basically, that's right along that walkway. The police officer had, as he had explained it, the apartments that would be behind me on 5th Street, their back faces that courtyard. But the apartments that he had just walked through the passageway, they face there also.
The record doesn't show that anyone actually saw this defendant urinating.
That's true. It did not. And again, Your Honor, that may go to the eventual, is he guilty? Can the state prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? But does it create a risk? Sure it does. We don't use public areas as public toilets. We don't urinate in a bush simply because no one is looking in a place where people will be walking. I am sure that perhaps the next day, the residents of that apartment would not like to know that someone had been there, a mother who lets her children go out and play in that courtyard, kids who play hide and seek in those very bushes, perhaps. That's not what that public area is there for. So does he create a risk by creating a physically offensive condition when he decides to use that area as a urinal? The state suggests yes, and that's exactly what 1301 prohibits. And it may prohibit it under B in certain circumstances, if it's a display where it has more of a communicative type reason, or it can be creating a physically offensive condition by using a public area that people should have free access to and not have to worry about whether someone has been using it as a bathroom. So the state suggests that it's clear under Delaware law that, in fact, this would be disorderly conduct. I'd suggest that gets us to the gets me at least to the last argument that the defense makes, and that says, well, then McDonald is applicable, and the state can't argue now if 1301F is the more applicable 1301F. And I believe the Chief Justice got it exactly correct. That doesn't matter. The question are facts, and even in McDonald, the question was there sufficient evidence that the police officer had those facts in mind that would have led him to arrest, in that case, for the unregistered motor vehicle? And using the affidavit of probable cause really as somewhat impeachment evidence as to whether or not that was in fact true at that time, this court found no. In this case, the facts are exactly the same. There is no fact that needs to be changed. There is no other fact that he needs to know. He saw what he saw. Could he have investigated more? I guess he could have gone into the bushes to check. But if we look at the affidavit of probable cause, which they do, the situation had changed by then. He had already found the drugs, and he went back to look for illegal substances or weapons. That's exactly what he said he was looking for, not further evidence that, in fact, the man was urinating, as he had seen.
I gather that you would agree that if this defendant had been urinating as a gesture of political protest, that would clearly fall within the disorderly conduct statute.
Under B, yes.
All right. What if the defendant was simply physically incontinent?
Well, I think, and the New York court in People versus Cook dealt with that in some circumstance. I think in those circumstances, I mean, there are other defenses.
How should we deal with it?
Excuse me?
How should we deal with it? The risk is still there.
I think that's a choice of evil situation then, Your Honor. The person then has to make a decision as to whether or not, for instance, they urinate themselves or they create that risk. And I'd suggest that the choice of evils, which is a known and statutory defense here in Delaware, would probably cover that situation where the person, because of necessity, and as I said in People versus Cook, they talk about necessity or urgency in those types of circumstances as
but
being what, possible defenses.
But from a strictly legalistic standpoint, doctrinal standpoint, how do you, on what basis do you argue that that case would not be covered by the disorderly conduct statute?
Well, I suggest it is. In fact,
it would be disorderly conduct.
It would be disorderly conduct, but he would have a valid legal defense to it.
Namely?
Namely choice of evils. I urinate on myself, or I go to a circumstance where I try to do my best not to inconvenience people, but I may create that inconvenience.
Was there a choice of evils defense statute?
In Delaware?
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's in the 260s, Your Honor. It's under justification, if I remember correctly. But just choice of evil certainly is a known defense, and it's been cited by this court, I think, in Bodner, Bodner versus State, which was a DUI case in which a person had to get in the car to get it off of railroad tracks. So choice of evil certainly has been a recognized defense in Delaware. And I suggest that in those circumstances that would be the valid defense. So choice of evils always says the person actually did commit the crime, but there is a valid legal defense to it that excuses it. And I think that was the idea that the New York court was getting into in People versus Cook. If the court has no further questions, I have no further argument.
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
We never get to choice of evils because under Mr. Wallace's statute, 13011F, the physically offensive condition that is created is only unlawful if it serves no legitimate purpose. So under Justice Jacobs' hypothetical, that person would be obviously serving a legitimate purpose. Do we have any inkling whatsoever whether Negron was achieving a legitimate purpose or not? It could be read many different ways, but that was not even looked into. And the officer did not cite any factors, as stated before, to support that. The state did not fairly present its argument today to the lower court. And the state says it's not clear from the record. It's very clear from the record. The affidavit of probable cause says 13011B. The indictment says 13011B. And for the state to come before this court and say that Mr. Negron is in the right church and the wrong pew is belied by the record. The state cannot proceed against an individual, base a stop on something, and then on appeal come before the court and say, well, that's not what we meant. This is what we meant. So can you please uphold the stop? There was no reasonable suspicion for either of these statutes because no one saw the urination, not even the officer. And because of that, he had a hunch.
Well, let's assume that the trial court relied upon the wrong statute. Does that mean on appeal that we cannot uphold the decision based on an alternative ground?
Well, actually, the answer to that question, it would be, if I have the question right, yes, the court could reverse it if there were objective factors before the court to justify that, and there are none. And in fact, the court said he based his decision on the officer's belief that he may have violated disorderly conduct. And the good faith exception doesn't apply here. So the court never said there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause of disorderly conduct. He said he had a belief that he had violated the statute, so that was enough. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.